of his writings, but it seems extremely apt today, a nice way to get into our subject. The story has it that in a little village in India, let me think now how to get this right. The Brahmins came and complained that their fire ceremonies were being interrupted by the presence of a demon. And that just at the critical moment, the demon would come and he would throw unclean things into the fire and cause the whole benefit of the fire ceremony to be neutralized by his wrong vibrations. Whether this was a literal true story or not, it works for what we're trying to say here. So they appealed to a more powerful priest, and the priest summoned the Brahmins to him, and he said, "Here is this powder that I have impregnated with a certain mystic force, and the next time you're doing your fire ceremonies and that demon appears and wants to interrupt the purity of your ceremony, take this powder and shake it on him, and that'll cause him to go away." So the Brahmins were greatly encouraged by this, and they with great confidence went forward and did their ceremony, and just at the critical moment, once again, the demon appeared. And they shook the powder on him, and it had no effect at all. And they said, they were completely, "How can this be?" And the demon just smiled. He said, "Long before the Brahmin blessed it," he said, "I got into that powder first." Now, this story, which is who knows what level of reality it actually comes from, represents the difficulty that we all go through in our own spiritual efforts, because the tools that we're using to liberate ourselves from delusion have already been permeated with delusion. It's the mind, it's the ego. Now, it's not as if these forces are not useful to us, and this is a very important balancing point we need to understand. Sometimes I've given a class, I and others, and the title is very simply Ego, Friend or Foe. And because we have to understand that it is the capacity to see ourselves objectively as individuals and focus our willpower toward whatever goal we've set that actually really distinguishes us from less evolved creatures, all the animals on the planet, for example. All the dogs and cats and horses and so on are all essentially just like us, but they're at a much lesser stage of evolution. Swamiji made the interesting comment once. He said he looks at all creatures, he said, including the animals. He said, and you can see that they're all just the same on this spectrum of evolution from unconsciousness to superconsciousness. But there's a dividing line that comes when you come into human form, or let's say gradually as you have human form more often. Animals evolve, the way the masters put it, automatically, because they don't have a sufficient ego to objectify themselves. They just sort of move through the process of that species with energy and gradually come into greater and greater consciousness until an animal form no longer serves them. Then they begin to have human bodies. But the human being has a distinct enough sense of self-awareness and a distinct enough ego that ego can consciously reflect on what's happening and make decisions based on a broader perspective, putting it this way. When a dog, for example, finds himself homeless with nothing to eat, he doesn't have the capacity to reflect that he is now homeless, even as dogs in Brazil sometimes find themselves homeless. And you know that he's been homeless for 3 days, and before that he had a nice warm home, but this has only been 3 days, and maybe after 2 more weeks, you know, there's not enough development either to reflect in that abstract way or to see himself distinctly. And in fact, even though animals suffer, you can see the suffering in them, they don't suffer nearly as much as people think they do. Because that lack of self-awareness simplifies. They don't add to their physical suffering the mental suffering that the ego allows us to have. Because when the dog is homeless, he's just hungry, and he just thinks about eating. One of my friends once had a dream in which he very vividly went into the body of a bear, And it was so, it was like a super conscious dream going into a subconscious state, but it was a real state. And he came out afterwards, out of his dream, and he said it was so interesting because the bear's entire consciousness was just eating and sleeping. It was, the bear was hungry, and so he looked for something to eat, and then he was tired, and he went to sleep, and then he woke up, and he was hungry again, and he went to, you know, he didn't, as I was saying, reflect abstractly on the condition of bears. It was just hunger. So when a dog or a cat, even a relatively more highly evolved animal, he's just hungry. He doesn't add to it all the mental anguish of how long will I be hungry, and, oh, I was hungry as a pup, and my mother, you know, gave more milk to the bigger one and didn't like me. I mean, think how much of our suffering. Oh, I was just thinking of that. Do you? Many of you, I'm sure, saw the movie Winged Migration, which was that beautiful documentary about the animals. The first scene of that, some of you may recall, you have these two fledglings in a nest. And I don't know whether they were fledglings of the same species or one of them had been an egg dropped in there by another species, but you had a little fledgling and a bigger fledgling, and they looked like plucked chickens. They didn't have any, and this is all, you know, just the first scene of the movie, this big, on the huge screen, you have the little nest, and then you have the bigger fledgling and the smaller fledgling, and the big fledgling is conscientiously pushing the small one out of the nest because he's just thinking of survival. He's not thinking abstractly, ah, the same spirit that beats in my heart beats in the heart of my little fledgling brother. He's thinking more for me. Even not even that consciously. He's just sort of there, and this other fledgling, somehow he doesn't want him there, and he just pushes him out of the nest. I thought, my God, you know, millions of incarnations later, these two beings probably still hate each other. You know, how early it all begins, of this sort of fighting against and trying to get for ourselves. Well, I was trying to say, by the time we get to the ego level, it is a blessing, because then we can consciously apply ourselves to the task of avoiding pain and experiencing bliss. Because no matter how complex it gets, no matter how involved, that's really on the bottom line, this is all that all conscious beings are trying to do. They're trying to get away from suffering, and they're trying to get into bliss. Now, whether they call that bliss sensual enjoyment, worldly power, more food, a warm place to sleep, less work, still, it's always on the spectrum. This is in some way painful to me, this is less painful, and this is what I'm going to do. And the ego is our absolute friend in this, because it allows us to work consciously for that objective. And we have to go through many, many incarnations of really developing this ego power, because without it, nothing will happen. And our ego really becomes a fundamental ally in our search for happiness, because it can objectify, it can discriminate, it can exercise willpower and go forward. And in fact, you have to have a fairly well-functioning ego even to get onto the spiritual path, because it takes a very sophisticated ability to discern. And oftentimes, in fact, people will wrongly try to use the spiritual path to avoid having to take that kind of responsibility, getting into a kind of passive spirituality that's either based on dogmatic religion, I just follow these rules and then everything's going to be okay for me, or a passivity that says, oh, I'm supposed to overcome the ego and I don't even have the courage to have one, so I'll just pretend I'm surrendering to God. But sooner or later, that never works. There has to be this healthy functioning self, and then we can decide, but what is the limit of this? This is when Lori was reading today. She talked about the boat of my little consciousness, however Master was saying it in that beautiful poem, attracted to what Master called the rocks of insatiable desires. I thought that was, Master uses words so beautifully. That book of Whispers from Eternity, which is Master calls a book of answered prayers, revealed poems, he says, he advises us, and I myself have not yet followed this instruction because huff puff, Master has a lot of different things for us to do, but it intrigues me enormously. He says one should memorize those poems one at a time, and just repeat it over and over and over again until every word of it has become alive with the inner meaning of it. And just that little phrase, the rocks of insatiable desires. And sometimes we think insatiable, that only certain desires are insatiable, but that's not what Master means by that. What he means is that all desires are insatiable, except the one all-fulfilling desire for the infinite. Why is that? Because everything that we seek outside of ourselves will never be able to absorb completely enough to really satisfy this inner longing that we have. So we, to come back to the story of the demon and the ego helps us come to the point of recognizing the limits of the ego, is really how I want to put it. And that story about the demon is simply that, that our own minds and our own ego can help us only up to a certain point, because it's already, by its very definition, been doused in the powder of delusion, because the ego itself is the soul identified with the body. That's how Master defined it, such a beautiful, neutral definition. The ego is the soul, which is infinite and one with all of creation, identified with this physical body, and therefore making all its decisions based on our mortality, on our apparent separateness, on all the transitory definitions of self that we really begin to act as if they were really ours, all of the things that that entails. It's a wonderful idea to meditate on, because I don't just mean, it doesn't just mean that I'm living through the senses or living only for physical things. It's all the implications of what would I be like if I really knew that I wasn't only just this body. Years ago, when I used to work up at the Expanding Light at Ananda Village, we gave classes. I was giving a class, I think, on the chakras or something like that. Or it really doesn't make any difference. And as part of what we did in the summer, we went down to the Yuba River. And the Yuba River there is in a deep canyon, and there are these huge granite stones on the canyon, and parts of the canyon are quite narrow. And it was a hot summer day, and we went down and swam in the river, and then we were lying out on the rocks. And I can just remember being stretched out like this on this granite rock, which in and of itself was quite remarkable, because that rock had been there so long, and the rock had so much just solid, immutable power. Even the pounding force of the river, which was enormous, you know, couldn't budge it or even affect it except so slowly and such a small amount. And my little tiny, you know, form, which could have been snuffed out in an instant, just sort of letting all the molecules of your body just go into the rock and feel what it would be like to be a granite rock, which is an exercise that we do when we're tuning into the chakras, because the first chakra is the power of the earth and that immutable power of stone. I am irrevocably committed, and I have loyalty to truth, and nothing can move me. And one identifies not with all of the transitory, but with that rock. And then I opened my eyes, and way up high in the sky, there was a single hawk just flying around like that. And all of a sudden, just by, you know, expansion of imagination, I thought, what do I look like to that hawk, looking down, you know, down and seeing this little splat of plasma, you know, sort of on this giant rock? And what would it be like if my consciousness was able to go in all these directions at the same time? Now, of course, it was only imagination, visualization, but Master says that's a very important part of spiritual progress, because it begins to break the delusion of this imagination that we're working with all the time. And even though it wasn't super conscious, it hinted at that. And I thought, oh, how differently I would live my life if I had the power of the rock and the perspective of the hawk. And I thought, is it any more true just to live in this body than to live in those realities? It's just the habit. But you see, the mind always comes back to this one. That's the delusion that we run the world from this perspective. Master made the comment once. He He said, we make a grave mistake when we think that everything that happens to us concerns us personally. It was just sort of like the first time I heard that, I thought, well, of course it does. And I thought, no, not really. You know, lying on the rock, looking at the hawk, you just see that just I, the little ego, floating in the great infinite spirit, there's just so much more that's happening. The ego gives us the capacity to see that there's a world beyond it. But then we're faced with this tremendous challenge, which is how do we get out of the very thing that we are? And this is where the masters intervene, thank God, really, literally, thank God. And through the power of Scripture and the example of their own lives and the example of others who follow this, we begin to see. And one of the promises, the guiding signs of this, is this the Bible verse that we read very simply today, which we read every day in the festival, every week in the Festival of Light. Swami, when he created this ritual of the Festival of Light, which is the second half of our service, when he first did it, it was 20 years ago now. So many of you, a whole generation of Ananda devotees, have never known a world without it. But it was an inspiration he had when he was in seclusion in Assisi, Italy, that we needed to add into what we offered, something ritualistic. And at that time at Ananda, when he did that, there was a fairly substantial counter wave of opposition to anything that even hinted of being organized in that respect. But he said it himself, that you know, these truths are so subtle, they need to be repeated and repeated and repeated. And also he said the power of ritual is that it becomes a familiar repetition and allows you to not have to relate to it so much from the mind, but just accept it into yourself on ever deeper levels. Just like Master was saying, memorize those poems and say them again and again. That's not beneficial if the origin point of what you're repeating is not does not come from a superconscious source, because then you just repeat it and repeat it and you get lower and lower, like television commercials and things like that, that just go in your mind and make you crazy, and you just get onto a lower and lower vibration by doing them. But that which comes from a superconscious source, the more you can get in tune with it, the more those very words and the meaning of the words go deeper and deeper into your soul. And one of the pieces of scripture that Swamiji put into the Festival of Light, as many as received him, to them gave he the power to become the sons of God. Now, we just say that over and over and over, because that is the key. Because there is a point at which the ego simply says, I've reached the limits of my own understanding. The delusion of self permeates myself. And something more has to come in to break that boundary completely. And that power is the receiving of the consciousness that we're trying to have. Because we're just, it gets so difficult to try to say this, but it's so extraordinarily true that what we call our consciousness is completely arbitrary. The only thing that makes it seem so fixed is that we've done it for such a long time. Even the river can wear away the granite stone if it just keeps pounding and pounding on that same point. For so many incarnations, we've lived as this self that we've just made the simple mistake of thinking this is who we really are. Every time we shed this body, every time in reincarnation when we shed this body, there's this sudden realization at the moment of passing, oh my gosh, I was never really that body at all. Many people who have the grace to transition out of this world with a period of knowing that it's coming, they often have these out-of-body experiences in which they suddenly just stand back and realize, I've been standing on a stage this whole time. This was just a part I was assigned, and I just became so engrossed in this role that I forgot it was a play. And then there's this great, joyous realization that it was just a part. That was all I was doing. This is the power that comes into us. This is what we can receive. is the Master's clear perception, the Master's consciousness, the presence and power of God coming into us just in an instant. And all of a sudden, the delusion just fades away, and we see ourselves as God has always seen us. Master once was looking out at all his disciples, and he said, "Oh, if you could see yourselves as I see you," he said, "you would realize that you are nothing but radiant light." Oftentimes, you can sort of see in Swamiji's eyes when he looks out at people, and that was Swami's comment, that people are all, everything is just the same, just egos and individual consciousness struggling to be free. Just these last few days, I spent a few days in the company of this Indian Swami named Shankarananda, who's a friend of Ananda's, and he's a disciple of a disciple of Sri Yukteswar, so he practices Kriya through a slightly different lineage. And he was visiting, he lives in India, he was visiting America, and I drove him up to Ananda Village. And when we were driving home from Ananda Village, there was just this moment where we were at a stop sign, and in a car next to us, the window was rolled down about a foot, and there was some little dog, sort of a little terrier, and he had, you know, extended himself out of the car window as far as he could, given how far it was open. I'm sure his owner knew just how far that had to be. And the dog was so excited, like this, you know, just every single direction looking. And this particular Swami has an attunement with animals. He likes animals. And he sort of points over to the dog. And then Swamiji rolls down his window. And you can see he's trying to get the attention of the dog. He wanted to give the dog a higher consciousness. He was trying to help the dog. I mean, animals are just going to be people someday. And this Swami wanted to help the dog, and we laughed. I said, "He's so restless, even with you with the window open, leaning out," I said, "he can't find you." And it was just such an extraordinary illustration, because the dog was desperately searching for something, I don't know what, but he couldn't stop searching long enough to realize that what he was looking for was right in front of him, you know, on a very deep level. So I think Swamiji gave that poor little pup as much as the pup could take, and then we all went our own ways. And then I read this Sunday reading today, "As many as received him, to them gave he the power." And I thought that was it right there, wasn't it? You see, the consciousness of divinity in a universal sense, and specifically the consciousness of the masters whose pictures are on our altar, the presence of Christ, Krishna, Saint Francis, every great soul that ever lived, the masters themselves say, that consciousness never goes away. It's always there and can always be retrieved by the power of devotion. And we also have to understand, it's a very extraordinary to contemplate. You see, we take physical bodies for reasons we can't access with our conscious mind. We have this compelling force of desire that can only be fulfilled in the physical world. And so we find ourselves again and again inhabiting physical bodies. And we just gradually wake up to the fact, whoa, here I am again. You see little babies, you know, just kind of peering out, being picked up and carted here and there by these doting parents and being smothered in kisses by mother. And you can just sometimes see the baby just thinking, what is going on here? You know, here I am again. I'll never forget the look on the face of a child with a very high consciousness. His diaper was being changed. He was lying on his back. His mother had, you know how the poor mothers grab the ankles of the little baby and lift his little bottom up like this? I mean, it's absolutely humiliating. And he just, you could see this child, he just was gazing off like this. You could almost just see him, "I am not here, this is not happening. You know, I cannot be here again at the diaper stage." It was just too agonizing for him. You know, and then gradually we get out of the diaper stage and we find our way onto this planet. Just to digress for just a moment, this a woman, Happy Winningham, had AIDS, and she lived about 8 years from when AIDS came full-blown into her life, and she had a number of decisions to make, because The doctors were treating her in various ways, and she'd had several, death and return experiences, and she had no fear of dying. So she finally said to Swami, essentially, how long should I keep trying? I'm going to die from this disease, is going to take my life eventually, and I don't really care. How long should I keep trying to live? Swami's answer was perfect. He said, the chances are that you're going to have to take another body. And he said, and if you take another body, you're just going to have to go through all that long period of first being a baby, then a child, then an adolescent, and finding your spiritual path again, and then getting the training and learning to do Kriya. He said, why waste all that time? He said, as long as this body is strong enough for you to do Kriya, or at least practice the presence of God, you should hold on to it. At the point at which it becomes, the weakness of the body totally interferes with your capacity to remember God's presence, at that point, let it go. It was such a simple, practical piece of advice. This is what the body is for. Let's not waste it. And in her particular case, she learned a great deal of willpower and determination and discipline during those years that she remained in her body that she wouldn't have learned otherwise. But coming back to what I was trying to say about the dog and the Swami, we incarnate in this world because we have to. The masters come out of compassion. Greater can no love be than this, willingly to sacrifice the freedom of the infinite to accept the bondage of a human body and human life, which a master does. Even though his consciousness is free, he's still bound by the material world only for the sake of others. The masters live only for the sake of others. The masters joyfully endure, literally, crucifixion, because in doing so, it will help others. We don't have the capacity to understand how active that love is, how constant that love is. Just like the Swami, here's this little dog. Swami Shankarananda knew the dog was looking for higher consciousness in his way, unrolled his window, was just eager to give it to him. Of course, there was no hardship involved, but it was such a sweet gesture, trying to reach out like that. Constantly, the masters are trying to reach us. And we're so busy looking here and there. And what they want to give us is the power. And that power has to come from a higher source than just the ego. It has to be a clarity, an angelic clarity, stronger than the demon of self. And to all those who received him, he gives you the power. If you just look in the right direction, accept that power in you, then you find effortlessly, literally effortlessly, the ego just begins to dissolve. Because the illusion of separateness cannot stand against the experience of oneness with all. The selfishness and the fear that binds us to ego cannot stand against the experience of bliss. This is all that is the spiritual path is. All of our meditation, all of our prayer, energization, right action, right attitude, service, everything is designed for one purpose, which is to align us sufficiently so that we can receive that power. That's why, as the reading goes on to say, attunement is everything. Receive that power, attune yourself to it, focus your life around it, and the power to become, even as the great ones are, becomes our own.